thanks for inviting me to speak. So I'd like to tell you about some non-Kähler hadronic compactifications, but this will be hopefully at more of a pedagogical pace. So if I say something that doesn't make sense, you know, please stop me. I suppose you'd be invited to even if it weren't pedagogical, but okay. So first of all, so I guess I'm not going to write much down. So the motivation is that since the creation of hadronic string theory, like 25 years ago, there has been sort of tremendous hope of building semi-realistic models of particle physics from string theory. The progress has been pretty good, and there's lots of recent work in hadronic string theory with semi-realistic models, but they usually suffer from the same sort of problem, which is that they have many massless scalar fields in four dimensions. So in type 2 theories, one of the ways that people have started to lift these massless moduli is by turning on fluxes or brain sources. And that's all well and good, and there are lots of semi-realistic F-theory models, type 2B models, that people have constructed. So you might wonder, why should we care about hadronic anymore? And the reason that I still care about hadronic is because hadronic still provides us an opportunity to have a microscopic description of the physics going on, because we still have a chance to write down some worldsheet model that incorporates fluxes. Whereas in the type 2 case, we still don't know how to write down a model that incorporates all possible Ramon-Ramon flux backgrounds. So, right. So that's why I'm interested in hadronic. Great. So why hasn't it happened yet? Or why hasn't that much been done yet, even though some work has been done? So, all right, we've got this chain, and don't look for any pattern in these numbers. So in 1986, there was a paper by Andy Strominger called Superstrings with Torsion. And there he sort of translated the supersymmetry preserving conditions in a generic flux background in hadronic theory into some geometrical constraints, which may have made the problem look a lot more approachable, since you could perhaps hand them on a piece of paper to a mathematician friend. But unfortunately, that system turned out to prove to be very difficult to solve. And at least the first torsional hadronic background that I know of was written down in 1999 through a chain of dualities from M-theory and F-theory backgrounds by Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Sethi. And even then, so various people studied various aspects of non-Kähler manifolds and these backgrounds in particular, but it didn't really seem to be until 2006 where people really started to be able to solve this system directly in the hadronic supergravity. And so this was some work done by various authors, so the two Becker sisters, Fu, Tsung, and Yao, was a paper that appeared in 2006 doing just that, where they showed the existence of a certain class of non-Kähler T2 bundles over K3 with some non-trivial vector bundles. Okay. But even since then, it's been fairly difficult, unless Melanie wants to correct me, to solve for the four-dimensional phenomenology of these models. But fair enough. What's that? Yeah, the bundles are hard. Exactly. So even still, there's plenty of work to be done even within this class of non-Kähler compactifications. And I think that so the biggest difficulties are the bundles, and also I think, at least for a long time, solving the modified Bianchi identity for the Ramon-Ramon H-flux was one of the big problems. Okay. So in hadronic theory, we have this modified Bianchi identity. And let me remind you for a minute where this comes from, because we'll sort of come back to it in this form later. So the world sheet action of the hadronic string contains terms like the pullback of the B field. It contains right-handed fermions that transform with a connection that's the pullback of some connection from spacetime. And it contains left-handed fermions that transform, again, with a connection that's the pullback of some spacetime connection. Okay. Plus other things. And so the point here is that we have, on the world sheet, we have chiral fermions that transform under some local gauge symmetries. And so at the world sheet level already, we have to worry about gauge anomalies. And in fact, if we worry about those, and we look at the transformation of the fermion measure under a space-time Lorentz transformation and space-time gauge transformation, indeed, the measure transforms, and it looks something like this. So lambda is parameterizing local Lorentz transformations in space-time, and alpha parameterizes local gauge transformations in space-time. Okay. And the way that we cancel this, as we all know, is the Green-Schwarz mechanism, where we decide to cancel this by letting the B field shift under local Lorentz transformations and gauge transformations. Okay. So the Green-Schwarz mechanism works by canceling a classical variation of the action against the one loop variation of the measure. Okay. Great. So that's something to keep in mind for later. All right, so now let me tell you about, let me go back to supergravity and tell you about these heterotic backgrounds with torsion. So first of all, this is for compactification down to four flat dimensions, perhaps with some warped product with some six-dimensional internal manifold. So to preserve supersymmetry in four dimensions, this internal manifold should be complex, which means that we can write down some Hermitian 1-1 form, which is not necessarily closed. If it's closed, then this would be a killer. Second of all, we have to have the first turn class of the tangent bundle vanish, which is what tells us that there exists some connection with restricted holonomy, so that there exists some nowhere vanishing spinner, and we get some killing spinners in four dimensions. And this is equivalent to finding some nowhere vanishing holomorphic 3-0 form on K. Okay. We also get some relation between the three-form flux and the Kähler and the Hermitian form, as well as the dilaton and the H-flux. And then finally, we have the gauge bundle conditions, which just tell us that the gauge bundle has to admit a connection that's Hermitian-Yang-Mills, which means F is 1-1 form, and it's traced with J vanishes. Okay. So this
is phi?
Sorry, say that again.
What was phi?
Phi is the dilaton. So this is the system that we have to solve combined with the modified Bianchi identity. Okay. So any questions before I start describing the particular solution? Okay, so this particular model is based on work by various authors, Dasgupta, Rajesh, and Seti, Goldstein, Prakushkin, Beckers, and Fu and Yao, and the list, I think, goes on. And this class of solutions is constructed as a T2 bundle over a K3 base. And this T2 bundle is itself the fiberwise product of two circle bundles over the base K3. And so can people read here? Sort of. So we can write local coordinates on the fiber as, let's say, theta 1 plus I theta 2. We have some local connection on the bundle. A local connection with curvature form omega. This is d alpha. And from these quantities, we can construct a global. We can construct a global one-form, global on the total space K, which we'll call rho. Okay. So we have this global one-zero form on the total space, and the main point here is that we can use this one-form along with data that we already understand on the K3 to construct all of the quantities that we need on the total space K. So for example, the 3-0 form on K, we can write as omega wedged with the pullback of the holomorphic 2 form on K3. And the Kähler and the Hermitian form on K is related to rho wedge rho bar plus the pullback of the Kähler form on the K3 up to some warp factor that just depends on the K3 coordinates. Yeah.
DRS, is that they were doing things that were dual to flux vacuum, were 2A flux vacuum, or is that a different set of?
They were.
These are not really dual to the morphine.
Well, they are dual. They're dual to M theory compactification on K3 cross K3 with G flux and F theory and.
Okay.
Yeah, they go through like a whole chain of basically everything, relating these to everything. So at least for certain choices of bundle and curvature, they have duals. Okay, so these data allow us to satisfy these geometric constraints. This just defines for us essentially H and phi, and the only thing we have left to talk about is the gauge bundle and the Bianchi identity. And now that's easy to construct because we can look at gauge bundles over the K3, about which much is known, and we can take our bundle over the total space K, basically just to be the pullback of bundles over K3. And so this makes this class of solutions particularly, well, relatively simple to study, because for the most part, you just have to know facts about these bundles over K3. And it turns out that if the bundle over K3 is Hermitian Yang Mills, that also guarantees for you that the bundle over K is Hermitian Yang Mills. Okay. So now we've solved all of the supersymmetry constraints, and the only thing left to solve is the modified Bianchi identity. And basically, if we push this equation down to K3 and integrate, because essentially everything is defined on K3. So we can push this down to K3 and integrate, and we find out that dH basically goes like omega wedge omega on the base. Omega is the curvature of these S1 bundles. And this is equal to the integral of the second Schur class of the tangent bundle of K3 minus the second Schur class of the bundle over K3. OK. And so now it turns out that any time you satisfy the integral equation, there exists some function u which allows you to satisfy the full modified Bianchi identity. It's not Calabi-Yau. It emits no Kähler metric.
Oh, sorry.
But it's not Kähler. So in fact, it's topologically not Calabi-Yau. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, in fact, in supergravity, if you just go out to order alpha prime, there is an extra term in the 10-dimensional supergravity, which is the trace of which is basically just Riemann squared. I don't remember the sign, so I can't promise you that fixes this energy consideration. But
so you have a whole other 3-0 form that is not
Calabi-Yau. That's correct. So it just means
Kähler form is not closed.
Yeah. So it just means that there exists some connection, some metric compatible connection that has SU3 holonomy, but it has torsion. It's not the metric connection.
Something I've never understood for 25 years is that you're mixing different orders in the alpha prime expansion, right? That you're adding in the the Riemann squared term and not worrying about the higher ones. Is it just that there's some, why can you do this? Is it just there's some theorem that you can sort of, the higher terms will come in, but they'll just correct the solution, they won't change the solution space?
So. I don't know of any theorem to that effect. I don't know if Melanie does.
But you've been doing
it. It's the same thing in the type 2 theories, isn't it?
Same thing in
the
rock
theory.
So this is actually one of the reasons that we want a microscopic description is, so maybe we have an answer to this question, at least in particular examples. Well, it's not so clear. It's not so clear what the infrared geometry exactly looks like.
So you're not there.
I mean, topologically, so it's pretty clear that whatever the infrared geometry is, topologically, it's the same. And so maybe the metric may get corrected from this one, but topologically it's the same.
Is it a large radius solution in the infrared, or is it a small string radius?
In our models, I'm not actually sure what the radius is, but in general, so that's one thing that I was about to say. So let me say it, and then we can keep discussing. Is that when you take standard embedding, which just means that you give a bev to the gauge connection so that the right-hand side cancels and you set h equals 0. You find that you have a symmetry in the equations of motion where you can rescale h and you can rescale the metric. And at least at each order in alpha prime, the equations of motion scale homogeneously. So if you have one solution, you have a whole family of solutions, and you can take a large radius limit. Okay. And and so you can suppress alpha prime corrections. Now, the modified Bianchi identity doesn't scale homogeneously, and so when we're playing these different effects that order alpha prime off each other, in general, there doesn't exist a large radius limit. So in our cases, I'm not actually sure what, at the end of the day, the scale of the infrared geometry is.
But you don't see a large radius limit. You can't take some parameter out and see it along your single line or a large radius.
Right, not really.
I do have type 2 radius, right? You can go from the same to one, use some type 2 radius, and it's going to be parameter, and you can call it by the one. It's the one is rated by SM, by SQLT, and T1, and T2, type 2, so that's the similar expansion parameter is not wrong, it's up to duality.
But what did it become? What did the large radius limit become?
You need to take two larger units, huh? Yeah. Because here there is a larger units, but there might be some.
Oh, there's
some
parameter, yes.
Okay. Well, so anyway, since I'm not so good at answering that question, that's why I'd rather just find a microscopic description and not have to worry about it. So let's do that. Okay, so we'd like to find some microscopic description. So in principle, that would be the CFT, the world sheet CFT of a string in this background, which would be some nonlinear signal model. But of course, in general, we may not know specifically what metrics are or the E-field is, and we may not be able to write down the nonlinear signal model. And even if we could, we might not be able to calculate anything in it. So instead of looking for nonlinear signal models, we use this trick that was developed 15 years ago by Witten and various other authors, including many in the audience. So we use a gauge linear signal model, where the idea is that is to find this conformal field theory as some infrared fixed point of some normalization group flow of a quantum field theory that we can actually do calculations in, and then look for quantities that we can compute that are protected by supersymmetry under a normalization group flow. That's the basic idea of gauge linear signal models. And in this case, it's generally particularly nice because these are super renormalizable gauge theories in two dimensions. So the ultraviolet theory is generally free, which means that computations are not so difficult. And in fact, there are plenty of interesting quantities of the conformal fixed point that we can compute in the ultraviolet, such as the massless spectrum. So at the end of the day, that's the approach that we'll take. Okay, so let me review first how gauge linear signal models work before I explain how we turn on this non-Keylerian. So first of all, the field content is chiral scalar fields, which contain a complex scalar and right-handed fermion. We have Fermi superfields, which contain a left-handed fermion and a complex auxiliary field. And we have vector superfields, which contain the components of the gauge potential, vector potential, as well as left-handed gauge genomes and a real auxiliary field G. So these are the generic fields that we have in our 0-2 gauge linear signal models. And in general, the action schematically, Keller potential, and we have some super potential, which is a function only of chiral fields. Okay. And for the most part, let me not say that. All right, so the generic superpotential we're going to consider is of the form I'll explain in 1 second what everything is. Okay, so we're going to take models with these chiral superfields. The gammas are Fermi superfields. So we have some U1 symmetry. In fact, we have some metal gauge symmetry under which phi is e to the iq lambda phi, where lambda is some chiral superfield. But we can use all the 1 degree of freedom from this chiral superfield to fix most of the components of one of the gauge, the vector superfields, to zero. And all that we're left with then is some U1 gauge symmetry. So at the end of the day, we have some U1 gauge symmetry. We'll call them charges of the phi's capital Q, charge of P minus N, gamma minus D, and gamma M, QM. Okay. Great. So in order for the superpotential to be gauge invariant, we see that G has to have charge plus V, and J has to have charge N minus QM. Okay. So now, remember the Fermi superfields, as well as the vector superfields, have auxiliary fields. When we integrate out the auxiliary fields, we wind up with a potential for the scalar fields. And we're going to analyze the potential in various regimes to understand what the low energy physics of the model is. Eliopoulos term that we turn on. In action, it contributes a term which looks like RD plus theta times the flux. Okay, so R plus I theta is some complex parameter, which is the complexified Eliopoulos parameter. Okay. So now let's look at two different regimes. So when we take this phi Eliopoulos parameter R to be large and positive, then the only way that we can set this term in the scalar potential to zero, which we want to do to look for supersymmetric vacua, is if at least one of the phis is non-zero. So this implies that, okay, this is bigger than zero. And now, to make the model have a nice geometric interpretation, we make some assumption on what functions we choose here, the g's and the j's. In particular, we assume that they're non-degenerate, which means that they only all simultaneously vanish at the origin of field space when all phi's are zero. Okay. So now by making this assumption, we see that the fact that at least one of the phi's is non-zero means that we can't have g vanish and all of the j's vanish. So that implies that first of all, g of phi has to be zero. And second of all, he has to be zero. Okay. That's the only way to make all of these terms vanish. So at the end of the day, we find that the supersymmetric vacua have this structure. And furthermore, we have some U1 symmetry that we have to quotient by. So let me review what's happened here. Is this too low? Okay. So originally we have these five. Let's say that they're n of them. And they parameterize some Cn. And then we restrict here. So this gives us something which is topologically 2n minus 1 sphere. And then we have to quotient all of this by our U1 gauge symmetry. And at the end of the way, this is done in exactly such a way to give us some n minus 1 dimensional weighted projective space. Okay. So now, in the low energy theory, we have scalar fields which parameterize some weighted projective space so far. And then there's one more step, which is restricting to d equals 0, which gives us some hypersurface inside of weighted projective space. Okay. So are there any questions about that?
Are you implying that some of the charges vanished here?
Not yet. I'm not yet, but I'll say something about that in a minute. But let me just say that all the charges I've written here are non-negative, so Q and D. So these are all, I'm assuming that all these are non-negative. Okay. So far we've just talked about the scalar fields. Let me talk about the left-handed fermions next. So for the left-handed fermions, from this term in the superpotential, we get Yukawa couplings of the form pi plus sum on m, m minus m, j on the pi, where pi plus is the right-handed fermion in the p multiply. Okay. And in general, since the phis are not vanishing, at least some combination of these j's doesn't vanish in this limit. And that means that some linear combination of the gammas get masked up against the phi. And at the end of the day, we're interested in the massless degrees of freedom that survive to the infrared. And, well, we can write very nicely what those are. So the massless degrees of freedom then are the gammas that satisfy this constraint. So these J's then will encode for us the vector bundle over S, under which the massless gammas transform as sections. The gammas are left-handed fermions from the world sheet that at the end of the day are going to transform as sections of your vector bundle. Pull back some sections.
I mean, so you haven't committed to anything that's on the television, but are they kind of rough, right?
Yeah.
And so right. You say now something, sometimes there won't be any.
Yes, good. Okay, so are running. So let me comment on that before I do anything else. Okay. I'll just do it here, sorry. Okay, so in general, we can compute, before integrating that, we can compute the one-point function for D. And of course, the leading term we get is just R. The next term we get comes from the scalar fields running around in a loop. Okay. And this, at high energies, this diverges like the sum on the charges, sum on Q minus N, times the log of your cutoff scale. Okay. So in general, R will run. So this is our effective. So in general, our effective will be plus or minus infinity. But if we choose our charges well to make this term vanish, we'll only at the end of the day wind up with a finite running of R. And so it'll still be a parameter in our theory. So in fact, what we do in 0-2 models, what we do is we add two more fields. Okay. We add a chiral superfield and a Fermi superfield. And the chiral superfield has charge minus sum on qi plus n. The Fermi superfield has the opposite charge, which lets us add a term to our superpotential. Which is basically just a mass term for these new fields. Okay. So by making this addition, at the end of the day, we can still choose these charges to be whatever we want, as long as we cancel them. And because we've given a mass term to these new fields that we've added, they won't appreciably change the infrared story. And these are often called spectator fields. Okay.
So this is where the non-Calabi-Yau nature of the geometry
will
come in?
No, this is still just the standard 0-2 GLSM story.
Sorry, so the sum of the charges bringing some of the weights downhole.
Yeah, okay, so I'll get to that point in a second. But for the moment what we've done is we've added two new fields to cancel this this infinite renormalization of R. But since we've given them a mass term, we can make that mass term as high as we like and not appreciably change the inference story that we've discussed. And in fact, when we talk about cohomology computations for the massless spectrum, because of this term, it'll turn out that they won't contribute at all to the Q-bar cohomology. So far, I haven't talked about trim classes of S.
But I guess Eva is wondering about how you would get the Calabi-Yau condition and your inputs of this.
Yeah, so that's actually what I'm about to get to. So maybe I should go ahead and do that then. Okay, so right now I'm doing the left-handed fermion. So the story for the right-handed fermions will be similar. We can package the information about the massless left-handed fermions into an exact sequence. So let me write it and then explain it. Okay, so the typical element here is just some choice of left-handed fermions, and these dues are their charges. So we can think of these as transforming as sections of line bundles over the base, the Q's being related to their curvatures. This I is the inclusion map, so whatever our massless vector bundle is, it's some isomorphic to some subbundle of this one. This next map here is exactly just multiplication by J, so it takes the gammas and sends them to the sum. Okay. So now I just repackage things in terms of this exact sequence, which tells me that E, which is isomorphic to the image of I, is equal to the kernel of J. And the kernel of J are just the left-handed fermions that satisfy this equation. So far all I've done is repackage what I already told you into something that looks a little fancier. And the usefulness of doing that is then we can actually read off exactly what the churn characters of our bundle is from this exact sequence. Because the sum of churn characters that with alternating sign in an exact sequence is zero. Okay, so this tells us that the churn character of our cage bundle is equal to the churn character of this, which I'll write this way, and I'll tell you what it is. Okay, so this tells us what the churn character of our gauge bundle is. where now I've called Ada. So Ada is basically the generator of H2 of this weighted projective space, okay, which restricts to some element of two cohomology of S. Okay, so all right, so that's the string character of the gauge bundle. In fact, if you go through the same sort of story for the tangent bundle, you also wind up with something very similar looking, now involving these charges, E to the N theta. Sorry, I mixed up N and D. Maybe minus one. Okay, great. So now we can talk a bit more about the geometry. Okay. So now we can look at the first string character of the tangent bundle, and we see that it's just the sum on qi minus d times theta, which vanishes if this vanishes. So if the sum on qi equals d, then c1 vanishes, and s is Calabi L. Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of, in the typical gauge linear sigma model story, yes. And once we add things to this, it's not entirely clear yet how, if that's still exactly true. But in the gauge linear sigma model, yes. Okay, so S is what's going to be K3. And then we're going to do something a little bit different than the standard story to get our T2 bundle over K3.
So you're saying if you don't
cross
the Calabi-Yau condition, you
can
still avoid running the bar.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I haven't thought a whole lot about that, but it's a little strange. It's a big difference from 2-2 models. Okay. Okay.
You said you couldn't do that.
Quite possibly, is it?
No.
Well, it could be that you have some other problem. I mean, maybe you generate a space-time superpotential or do something else too. There may be something else wrong with your model, but the problem isn't at the level of the running of R.
We're talking about
OCP1,
so there's no benefit
for an infrared.
Yes.
That's right. And maybe this is breaking the supersymmetry, but still not running.
If C1's not zero?
In space-time, maybe it's saying there's a marginal direction even at this classical level. Even without the superconformal.
Anyway, the question you really have to answer is about the full model, not about this one, right? I mean,
well,
this is a step towards constructing.
That's right. So for our examples, we're going to take C1 to vanish.
So it really hasn't coupled this to the T2 model yet. And maybe it's only to make sensible after you've done that.
So here there's no torsion so far.
That's right. So far everything is Keller and Calabi L when C1 vanishes.
In some things, you change it around.
Just because the coefficient that appears here is different from what's appearing here. It's,
right.
So. Okay. So at the end of the day, the infrared geometry in this space has these scalar fields, which the massless one parameterize some hypersurface in weighted projective space. And well, the right-handed fermions, if we went through this story, we find out they transform as sections of the tangent bundle to S, and the left-handed fermions, the massless ones, transform as sections of vector bundle over S. So this is exactly the field content of the nonlinear sigma model living on S with gauge bundle E. Okay, so this is how the gauge linear sigma model reproduces in infrared the nonlinear sigma model of some hadronic compactification. All right, so now I want to talk about torsion, which is where we do something new. And so first of all, how do we turn on B field? Now remember, the Phi Theliopolis term had some constant theta times the flux, the gauge flux. So we had some term that looked like this. This is basically the only bosonic term in the gauge linear sigma model action that breaks parity. And that's basically the same thing that the B field does in the nonlinear sigma model. And so this essentially gives us a B field, which is some constant times the hyperplane class of the weighted projective space. Okay. Okay, and of course then eb is zero because eta is in cohomology. So in the normal gauge linear sigma model we can turn on B field like this, but obviously that's not the sort of B field that we want to turn on to get torsion. So the first idea that you might have is to make theta dynamical, because then dB won't be zero. So we make theta dynamical, we give it some kinetic term. Okay. And now we have some B field such that dB is d theta wedge eta. Okay. But this still isn't quite what we want, because here now theta is some periodically valued boson, and so basically this just gives us some S1 times our original model, roughly speaking. And we want this S1, of course, to twist over the base. And furthermore, there's one other thing that we haven't discussed in this context yet. But for the nonlinear sigma model, we talked about the gauge anomaly. And of course, this is something that we have to worry about in gauge linear sigma models too. And the gauge anomaly just comes from it comes from a diagram with two fermions running around in a loop. And it goes like the integral of gauge parameter times the flux times the sum of the squares of the right-handed charges, of the charges of the right-handed fermions, minus the sum of the squares of the charges of the left-handed fermions. Okay. So that's a typical form of the gauge anomaly. And of course, notice that this has exactly the same form as the theta angle. And so now we'd like to do the GLSM equivalent of the Green-Schwarz mechanism, which is allow theta to shift under the gauge transformation. Okay? So when we do that, we modify the kinetic term for theta so that it's gauge invariant. And it turns out to get a nice supersymmetric model, we have to choose the same coefficient in front of theta as appears in here. And now, really to be supersymmetric, I need a complex boson, so there are two thetas here as well. Okay. And then, of course, after that, I handed fermion, which turned out to be free in West Amino Gauge. Okay, so now we have the classical variation of the action plus the one variation, which adds here this new term, NL squared. And so all we have to require is that this total thing vanish instead of just the quantum anomaly by itself. Okay, so that's the same as the Green-Schwarz mechanism in the nonlinear sigma model. Okay. No, let me leave that because I forgot to say something. Okay. So now, notice one other thing about this term. If you look back at our formula for the Chern characters, you'll see that this combination of coefficients is exactly proportional to the second Chern character of the gauge bundle minus the second Chern character of the tangent bundle minus this extra bit, NL squared, which, if it's still on the board, is exactly like, it's exactly like what we had in this construction here. So dH pushed down to the K3 base was the sum on the curvature form squared. And this is in cohomology of K3. Okay, so what we found then is that we exactly reproduced this modified Bianchi identity in cohomology of these non-Keeler compactifications. Okay. Where we've identified the curvature of the circle bundles with NL times the hyperplane class. Okay. So that is the geometric part of the story. So any questions about that?
Sorry, I lost where this of the NL are the charges of the phase.
That's right, the shift charges. Is there a question?
Did you say you need two of them?
We need two of them for, first of all, because we want a T2 bundle. And second of all, because to put them into a super multiplet, we have to have a chiral, we have to have a complex boson. So we need two real datas. Okay, because we, sorry. But I was just going to say, because you know, we still want to preserve 0, 2 a supersymmetry.
Can you say again what the spectator fields are and what they're doing?
What they are and what they're doing. So what they're doing is canceling the infinite running of the FI parameter R, so that R is a real modulus of the theory. And they're decoupled from everything else. The only interesting thing about them, besides their kinetic term, is a superpotential term that gives them both some mass. Why do they or why don't they?
Why do they?
Oh, they don't. They don't.
But if you integrate them out, why wouldn't R then run?
R does run, but it runs by a finite amount.
If you integrate them out, then you wouldn't balance the charges.
No, because
R dependent, is that what you're talking about?
Well, we have the other terms in the superpotential, and basically they run until we integrate out the other massless, the other massive fields in the superpotential, and once we've integrated those out, there's essentially no more running, sort of schematically. So it runs some finite amount, basically, between this mass scale and some other mass scale set by the rest of our superpotential. And then after that, there's no more running.
Why can't you take any non-Plob Young manifold and just cancel charges by adding spectators that don't seem to do anything? Plob Young condition has meaning in the usual.
You can, but you may run into trouble doing the other things that we haven't talked about just yet, which is finding essentially a 0-2 superconform algebra, or sorry, finding a conformal, a left-moving conformal algebra in the ultraviolet, and also this UNR, this special UNR symmetry. So you may run into trouble doing that, but I haven't thought about that.
Oh, okay,
where is it? If you're having trouble, you just put on the supersymmetry.
Well, you may even spoil, I don't want to say fact. So there's sort of an implicit assumption that there even exists a conformal fixed point. And there's a bit of supporting evidence that there really does in models where the charges are well chosen. And I didn't think about it, but it may be that if you don't choose C1 of the tangent bundle to be zero, you won't find the same evidence that there exists a conformal fixed point.
So, but didn't you want a K3? I mean, didn't you want C1 to be zero?
Yeah, in our case, we do want C1 to be zero. Well, we'd also be interested if we could construct some examples where C1 of a base isn't zero. But for now, we want that to be zero anyway, so.
Maybe a related question is, what is the status of protection of this formula for the running R? And the 2-2 is
I think it's also one loop exact, but I'm not sure. Other questions? Okay. All right. So now what? That we have our model. We want to do something with it, and what we want to do is we want to compute the massless spectrum. And the way that we're going to do that is in the Landau-Ginzburg phase of the model, which I didn't mention before. But if we run back through the same logic that we used in the case where R was large and positive, and apply it to this case, what we find out is that now P has to be non-zero. Which means that to set the other terms to zero, we have to have the values of all the phis vanish. And so now P will get a value, which is like the square root of R over N. Okay. And then we can use our U1 symmetry to fix the phase of P so that its value is exactly equal to this. All right, so now we've broken our U1 symmetry. But P had charge n, and so we haven't completely broken it, but we've broken it down to a Zn symmetry. Okay, so at the end of the day, in this phase, we wind up with a Landau-Ginzburg orbifold. So the effective superpotential, we can basically just replace P by its expectation value, and well, just to simplify, we can just rescale. We can rescale J and just write it like this. Okay. So now we have some 0-2 Landau-Ginzburg orbifold. And the nice thing about this phase is that it turns out to be very easy to do computations in it. Okay. So we have a 0-2 supersymmetry algebra. We have Q bar. And if there exists a conformal fixed point in the infrared, they should become part of the supercurrents, the zero modes of the supercurrents, which means that they commute to L0 plus. Well, of course, they do this in the ultraviolet too, but then L0 plus becomes part of the stress tensor. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to compute massless states, which means that we want to compute states that are annihilated by L plus, by L0 plus. Okay. And this is equivalent to representatives of keyboard homology. Okay. So instead of computing L0 on a bunch of states, we can compute Q-bar cohomology instead. And Q-bar cohomology in the 0-2 case is protected under RG flow. So we can compute this cohomology in the ultraviolet and trust that it's still there in infrared theory. Okay, and then we also need, that's just the right-moving part of the theory. We also need some left-moving L0 minus, because we need to restrict to states that are also annihilated by that. Okay. So where does that come from? All right. So it turns out, Eva and Witten wrote down some time ago, that you can find explicit chiral operators in the ultraviolet theory. So you can find some operator, which I'll call Z, that's in the chiral algebra in the ultraviolet. And you can compute this OPE in the ultraviolet. And it essentially has the OPE of a stress tensor. So now, you essentially, well, because it's in the chiral algebra, you expect that to some extent it's protected under RG flow. And so now you basically assert that this is the stress tensor of your infrared theory. It's not a completely unreasonable assertion. And by doing that, now you've defined some L0 minus, and you've also identified a putative left-moving central charge of your theory. Now, it also turns out that for there to exist such an operator in your ultraviolet theory, and for it to exist at one loop, there also has to exist some non-anomalous UNR symmetry. Okay. So this exists at one loop. If and only if there exists some non-anomalous UNR symmetry, And so the idea then is that this UNR symmetry fits into the 0-2 superconformal algebra in the infrared. Okay? And we can use this UNR symmetry to compute the right-moving central charge of the theory. Because in the superconformal algebra, the OPE of JR with itself gives you the central charge. Okay. So now from our construction, we have a conjectured infrared fixed point. We know its left and right moving central charges. We know an L0 minus operator that we can use to restrict to states that should be in the massless spectrum of the infrared theory. So we restrict to basically these steps. Okay. Alright, so this is how we go about computing the massless spectrum. But to actually do it, we still have to compute Q plus bar cohomology. And it turns out that in these cases, it's particularly simple to do it because Q plus bar splits into two terms. The first term is just the supercharge that you would get from essentially the kinetic terms in the theory, which makes it very easy to compute. So for example, the first term contains psi plus bar, d phi I. So the first part is simple, and the second term contains things coming from the super potential. Okay. And what turns out to be true is that actually both of these operators are nilpotent, and they anti-commute with each other. And so that means that you can essentially compute the full Q-bar cohomology essentially using perturbation series, where you start by computing the cohomology of the 3Q, and then you start successively computing the cohomology of Q bar 1 inside of the cohomology of Q bar 0. But it turns out there's some additional symmetry that actually makes this converge, this perturbation series converge, exactly after the first step. Okay. So actually, this cohomology problem is extremely, extremely straightforward to do, even if it can turn into a small mess, but it's extremely straightforward. And that's what makes these models so useful. You can actually compute things with them. Okay.
Sorry, Josh, can I just make one more try about this running off?
Sure.
Sorry to keep doing this.
Oh, that's okay.
I think maybe I just finally understood what you're saying.
Okay.
It should run to small radius because of this business of putting off different orders now. So I guess that's what you're saying.
From supergravity.
Yeah. So it's fine. You run down to the scale of these things, you rotate them out, then it runs. And it should run to some small radius. But you're preserving all the things you want in terms of the ingredients you need to get along using the formal theory and not take a lot off.
Yeah, that's right.
There's nothing that you want to cancel the arm running of R at all. If I understand.
Well, we wanted to cancel an infinite running of R. So that was...
Okay, sorry, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, but it runs to some small radius, ultimately. I'm sorry, if you start out at...
Okay. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I mean... It seems like if you're canceling this infinite running, this log of the cutoff scale, that the running that you have left is some finite shift of R, which means that you can tune the bare parameter to be whatever you want.
Okay.
It'll depend on that MS.
How much it shifts depends on MS, but. Canceling the infinite part shouldn't. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And then it's like you didn't add that. So.
Yeah, I was trying to reconcile the two questions that have been asked about that.
Yeah, I don't have a. Okay. Way of combining them.
So what part of your calculation becomes harder when you want to do what's over the meta surfaces? Something to
So let me say one more thing, which is that there also exists some current which corresponds to some ordinary U1 symmetry, we call it U1 lab. Which is also in the chiral algebra at one loop, if this corresponds to some U1 left, some non-anomalous U1 left symmetry. Okay. So now we have, on our gauge linear sigma model, we have a set of constraints. We have basically the constraint that the OPE, that this U1 left is not anomalous. Which basically means that LPE between J left and the gauge transformation vanishes. Sorry, I'm just trying to be a little schematic here. We have that the C1R symmetry is not anomalous. We have that the gauge symmetry itself should be non-anomalous. And finally, we have that that if you take this OPE, you want to get zero, because at the end of the day, you want this to be part of the left-moving algebra and this to be part of the right-moving algebra in the infrared, and so they shouldn't have any OPE with each other. So you have this series of constraints. And then there are even more constraints, because at the end of the day, you want C left to be some particular value. You want C left to be 6 plus the rank of your gauge bundle. And you want C right to also be 6. Okay? So you have this whole set of constraints that you want to satisfy, which severely restricts the charge choices that you can make in your model. And so now maybe you can remind me again what your question was.
So you said you have control when you want to generalize this from
yes.
Good.
So it comes in solving these constraints. So if we were doing, so we'd have the same story in a normal gauge linear sigma model, and it would turn out that to satisfy all of these constraints, you would have to have C1 of S be 0. Now, in our models, it's not completely clear that you're forced to set C1 of the base to 0. But it's a lot easier to satisfy them if you do. So there may be some room for us to look at different charge assignments and super potentials and see if we can find some consistent set of choices. But it's not at all obvious that we can. Great. So I think I've said all of the details I wanted to say, so I can essentially make a conclusion. Well, I'll say just a few qualitative details about a specific solution. So the details are that in the first model that we've computed, it turns out that it doesn't have nice phenomenological features that we wanted. The net number of generations is 0. And actually, this happens because, in fact, in our models, we're essentially always going to be forced to have n equals 2 space-time supersymmetry, as we sort of found out at the end of the day, unfortunately. And that basically traces back to the fact that the right-handed fermion in the torsion multiplet is free, and in all of the twisted sectors in this Landau-Ginzburg orbifold, you always have the two zero modes of this right-handed fermion, which give you pairs of states that differ in R charge by 1. And those always, in our models, they seem to always pair up to give you exactly space-time n equals 2. Okay, so that was kind of disappointing. And at least in this first model, we still have a fairly large number of moduli fields. So in that model, we didn't get the phenomenology we were hoping to get. But there's still room. Well, we think anyway that there's still room to do some interesting things. One of them is to see if we can find some way of modifying the base so that it doesn't have to have C1 equals 0. And then I suppose we'd have to understand this business about R a bit more thoroughly.
So the spectator thing is really a 0-2 thing, right? So
yes.
It's not the space, just a Calabi-Yau period. So it's something about how the vector bundle works?
You can't do it in type 2 because you can only do it with 0-2 supersymmetry.
Right. So it's something about how the vector bundle is stopping the running.
So the difference between the vector and the tangent bundle is sometimes the picture of the or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that it's not, causing what would otherwise be, say, you know, like walls and walls and small radius stops it somehow.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like a thing.
So Joe's in the audience, so I can make this analogy maybe. So there was this paper that you wrote with Steve Giddings and Andy, where you wrote down a putative CFT for hadronic theory on a two sphere, which had zero central charge, but nevertheless supposedly had some non-trivial spectrum. And so I think. I mean, it sort of looks like that here. If you just take S to be CP1, you know, you can cancel this. You seem to be able to cancel this infinite running of the FI term. And so it might be that if we wrote down some consistent model there, some model that looks consistent, at least in terms of these anomaly conditions, you might find out that it has to have zero central charge. So that's some sort of. Yeah. So in that sense, it may correspond to some sort of a stringy compactification. But okay, that's something I haven't.
Oh, you mean the degenerate? Not the general model, but that we had a degenerate model. We couldn't understand the special.
That's right. Yeah. If we had some model where we weren't setting C1 of this bundle to zero. Sorry, C1 of the tangent bundle to zero. Okay, so we have at least a few ideas of things that we can do with this. And we could also look at other bases, say Calabi-Yau three bases, where we take one S1 and fiber it over this Calabi-Yau. And we just take a simple product with the other S1, and then hope that, you know, we can learn something about maybe G2 compactifications that way. And then there was some more recent work by Alan and a student of his, Dave. I don't want to say his last name because I'll mispronounce it. But basically, instead of this torsion multiplet, they replaced this with some Gage-Wessimino-Witten model. And the Gage-Wessimino-Witten model naturally has some anomaly that you can cancel if you embed. It has some anomaly that you can play off the gauge anomaly in the same way that we played these two off of each other. So there are some ideas for future work, even though we have this n equals 2 supersymmetry. So other questions? We'd have to have some orbital on the. So to do it, we'd have some orbital that acts on these chi's. So maybe we could. Yeah. Yeah, I don't see why you can't. Seems reasonable.
It was surprising that you have trouble with the n=1 because for a particular twist you can get n=1 supersymmetry for the dubulous wall K3, right?
Well, so I think basically the curvature that we're always turning on is going to be related to these hyperplane classes. It's going to be some linear combination of them. So I think we're basically always turning on 1,1 curvature for these T2 bundles. And at least, you know, one of the ways to break it is to turn on 2,0 or 0,2 curvature, which I don't see how to do in these models.
So as far as Roswell, you're always going to have
I think you can always buy a G string.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to worry about those in these models.
So it's the same thing as the radio model is in type 2. Again, if you talk to one particular data, that's the same thing that we can send you around, it's the dilaton.